I want to talk to you a little bit about dating to help you get into the fallow concept. Have you ever dated anybody? I'm asking specifically the married people. Of course you did. Is there a more awkward time in a dating relationship than when you're kind of wondering what your relationship is with the other person? Huh? a number of years ago, before I met Liz, I was in a relationship, and I wasn't sure if I was in one or not. I wasn't sure if it was a friendship. I wasn't sure if the girl really liked me as a boyfriend. I wasn't sure how to act or behave, or I wasn't quite sure what to do. And those define the relationship moments, I think, are pretty important when you get together and you sit down and you're trembling and your palms are sweaty. And you're going to engage that person and kind of find out where you're sitting, right? Those are special moments, I think. They're necessary moments because they do define where you're going. They define a trajectory that you're going to follow. And I think it's interesting that God does the same thing with us. The whole fallow concept is embedded. It's found within a section of the Old Testament where God is really defining, it's a DTR moment. He's defining the relationship with his people, and that's what we're going to get into now. How do I work this? Is it just the click to the... Yeah, okay. That's a fallow field. It's a good visual of what it means to lie fallow. I want to read Exodus 23, that's where the concept of fallowness is really found. Basically, in terms of agriculture, you let the field lay fallow for an entire year. You don't cultivate it. You don't dig it up. You certainly don't plant any seeds. You just let it lay. And it's got a number of different benefits. But we're going to look at this concept in depth. But the first thing I think that you need to understand, that we all need to understand, is that this fallow concept is really a larger ripple in the whole Sabbath concept. I need to understand that it's really an extension of the whole Sabbath rest. Remember, God creates the entire world, and he forms it in 3 days, and he fills it in 3 days. And what does he do on the seventh day? He chills. He takes a break. He observes and he declares that everything is good. And so you've got to understand that the fallow season for a year is an extension of that. It's, I don't know if you want to think of it like a water drops in a pond, and the weekly cycle of Sabbath is the dot that hits the water, and then the larger ripples start to go out from there. There's more to Sabbath than just the seventh day, and that's what we're going to talk about tonight. We also have to understand a little bit of the context of the book of Exodus. It means exit, and how do I summarize it in a simple way? Israel, somebody's going to suggest it for me. Israel is in bondage, and God brings them out with an outstretched arm. He's going to love his people. And what we find here in the book of Exodus is the people have already been delivered from Egypt. They've been liberated. They've crossed the Red Sea. And they're on their way through the wilderness for this time of testing. And it's right before they're going, Moses is going to go before Mount Sinai and hear from God. It's the defining moment in terms of God defining the relationship. And right before this passage that we're going to look at tonight, is found the Ten Commandments. And if there was ever a moment when God defines his relationship with his people, it's then. He lays down his expectations. You know, you got a girl and you're saying, hey, I want you to stop drinking. I want you to stop smoking. I want you to stop running around with other guys. And you need to be faithful. If we're going to do this thing, you need to be sold out to one relationship, and that relationship is with me. And that's what that define the relationship moment is all about. You're really going after a heartfelt devotion and commitment mutually with one another. So that's what we find ourselves in. I love this because it's heart language. It's gospel, but it also speaks very deeply of relationship. And so I want to show you my next fancy slide here. Look at that, God rhythm. I want to read the passage. If you got a Bible, I don't know what page you're on, but turn to chapter 23 of Exodus and let's read a few verses. It's a pretty short section, so it's going to be easy for us to wade through it, I think. Verse 10 begins this way. And keep in mind that in chapter 20, God has just laid down the Ten Commandments, right? And I, if you want a fancy word, keep in mind that the Ten Commandments are what we call a synecdoche, okay? It's the worst-case scenario. So when God says, do not commit adultery, he's saying in a negative sense that you're not to do this negative behavior, go off and sleep with somebody else. And that's the worst-case scenario, but you got to think of it as an umbrella. And underneath that umbrella are all the other implications of the command. In other words, in a positive sense, when God says, do not commit adultery, he's saying what you ought to do in the opposite way, in a positive sense, is you're to nurture marriages. You're to nurture your own. You're to prepare for marriage. You're to look at the marriages around you and to see once how you can strengthen those. One of the themes that we have at the Village for 2010. And so keep that in mind. So God is defining this relationship. And then right after Exodus chapter 20, there's an entire section of about three chapters that deal with practical ways that God's people can live out these commandment principles. And this is what we find starting at verse 10 in chapter 23. So let's go there for a sec. It goes this way. For 6 years, you're to sow your fields and harvest the crops. But during the seventh year, let the land lie unplowed and unused. Then the poor among your people may get food from it, and the wild animals may eat what they leave. Do the same with your vineyard and your olive grove. 6 days do your work, but on the seventh day do not work, so that your ox, your donkey may rest, and the slave born in your household, and the alien as well may be refreshed. Be careful to do everything I've said to you. Do not invoke the names of other gods. Do not let them be heard on your lips. I want to just pause here. Let's just pray that God would open our eyes. God, I pray that you would that you'd meet with us where we're at. We come from a lot of different backgrounds, a lot of different perspectives. We're at different stages or levels in our spiritual pilgrimage. There are some here that have been walking with you for a long time, others that are just babies starting to drink milk and learning to crawl and walk. And I pray, God, that no matter where we're at, that you'd meet us and that you would apply this word and that you would make it meaningful to us. I pray that you bring transformation not only in the way we think, but also in the way that we feel and also in what we do because of what we've heard. So please be with us. In your name we pray. Amen. First thing I want to talk about is a God rhythm. Years ago, I used to work out quite extensively. I do a lot of strength training. And I was in pretty good shape. And I know what you're thinking right now. You're thinking, how could anyone get in better shape than I am, right? It's true. It's true. But one thing I loved about working out is that, you know, I had a certain rhythm to it all. There are certain things that I would do, like for upper body and lower body. And if you're familiar with weight training at all, you know that you've got, let's say, sets that you do of curls, and you have a certain bar or a certain technique that you do. You do 12 reps or 15 or whatever, and then you rest for a period of time. And if you're like me, you had a watch right there, you'd finish a set, and then you kind of time it, okay, about a minute and a half, and then you'd go at it again, and you'd crank on it, and then you'd give it another rest, and then you'd do three or four sets, whatever, and then about 3 minutes after that, you'd run over to the bench, and you'd lay down on the bench, and then you'd bring it down, and you'd do your reps and your sets, and you'd progress through an entire upper body workout. And the interesting thing about that, I think, is that you would have a period of activity and a period of rest. And then after your workout that day, then you'd have to wait a couple of days for your muscles to recover. And you'd have to eat a lot of protein. And for me, I ate a lot of carbs and sugars too, because that's what my muscles at the time demanded. But then you'd fall back into it. And then over the period of weeks and months, you would implement some cross-training to it. You wouldn't just want to go strength training with the weights and all that, but you'd want to go out and do some cardio work and all of these kind of things. And the point is that there's a rhythm to working out in a physical way. And what this passage, I think, is really beautiful about the passage is that it outlines how God has ordered life in such a way that there's a rhythm to it all. We find in verses 10 and 11 that God has ordered a yearly type rhythm or rest for the people and for the land. And then in verse 12, he talks about, this is really a kind of an echo of what he's outlined already in the Ten Commandments, the fourth commandment, that you should rest on the seventh day. And so there's a daily and a weekly cycle of rest. And then if you drop down to verse 14, you'll find that he says, three times a year you are to celebrate a festival to me. And there are actually more than three Jewish festivals, but they were all designed for the people to take a break, to pull back from what they were doing, and to focus and to engage themselves in fresh ways with God. You get the sense of it? There's a rhythm to it all. And when I think of, for us at the Village, the God rhythm, the fallow thing, it's a time, really, for us to pull back from the craziness of shopping. You know, there are times where I've been absolutely maddened by the Christmas shopping frenzy and going out and, you know, the policemen are out there and they're giving tickets for all the people with expired registration. You get in line and people are grouchy about buying stuff, and it just muddies the entire experience of focusing upon the season. And it just seems to me that for us at the Village, and for me personally and in our family, we're going to take the month of December just to pull back and to get back into a kingdom rhythm. Pull back enough where we can really sense and experience and feel that there's a rhythm to God's kingdom. And in a cognitive way, in a mental way, to think about, you know, the Advent, the four Sundays before Christmas, anticipating Jesus coming and being born, but also anticipating Jesus coming again, fulfilling his promise to come again in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. It's a time to get into the rhythm of the kingdom. And then to think beyond that in terms of, Pastor Eric has talked about celebrating Lent and Ash Wednesday, and just giving some reflection to, I guess, what you want to call the church calendar. You know, there's a rhythm to all of this. Advent and Christmas and Epiphany. I don't even know what that word means anymore. But Lent and Ash Wednesday, and then onto Easter, and then get into the summer. And I would say this, that I really believe that Jesus was actually born in the summertime. But there's no better day than the winter solstice, the shortest day of the year, to celebrate the light of the world coming into the world. So anyhow, I'll just reflect on that a little bit. The point is that there's a rhythm to all of this. And I'd encourage you in the month of December, give some thought and reflection to the rhythm of the kingdom. The rhythm to it all. My next fancy slide is this. I'm surprised that my fancy font didn't come through. Really fancy. I'll show it to you. If you want, I'll email it to you. Anyhow, there's no worse rhythm than that, right? God dependence. I mean, get a hold of this. You're a cultivator. You're in agriculture. That's the way you make your living. And you're supposed to go at it for broke for 6 years, and then you're supposed to trust God that he's going to provide for you in the fallow year. But get this, it's not just that God is going to provide for you on the seventh year that you're laying the ground fallow. That's not it. What it comes down to is that you're going to be without food for 3 years if you don't sow for one. And so what God is really saying is, you need to trust me. And I'm going to read something from Leviticus 25. It's really quite beautiful. It talks about this, the Sabbath year, verse 1 and following. The Lord said to Moses on Mount Sinai, "Speak to the Israelites and say to them, when you enter the land I'm going to give you, the land itself must observe a Sabbath to the Lord. For 6 years sow your fields, and for 6 years prune your vineyards and gather their crops. But in the seventh year, the land is to have a Sabbath of rest, a Sabbath to the Lord. Do not sow your fields or prune your vineyards. Do not reap what grows of itself or harvest the grapes of your untended vines. The land is to have a year of rest. Whatever the land yields during the Sabbath year will be food for you, for yourselves, for your manservant, for your maidservant, the hired worker, the temporary resident who lives among you, as well as your livestock and the wild animals in your land. Whatever the land produces may be eaten." So, you know, observing a fallow year is really an act of faith, because what you're doing in a physical way is you're pulling back from all that you ordinarily would do to earn a living and to have food to eat for yourself and for your family and for all of your livestock. But what you're really saying is, I'm going to do this at peril to myself, because I trust that God's word is true and right and good, and he's going to follow through and he's going to make good with what he said he's going to do. That's a pretty tall order when you're in the agriculture business. And in case some of you are wondering, here's the question. A little bit later on in chapter 25, verse 20, God says this. He asks the question. You may ask when you're in that scenario, "What will we eat in the seventh year if you don't plant or harvest our crops?" And then God says this in verse 21. "I will send you such a blessing in the sixth year that the land will yield enough for 3 years. While you plant during the eighth year, you will eat from the old crop and will continue to eat from it until the harvest of the ninth year comes in." So you're getting ready for the seventh year. You know that you're not going to do any work. You're going to give all of your livestock a little break from plowing, and all your servants and all the people within your gates. Think about that. To say, "I'm not going to plant my fields and plow them and harvest and everything for the seventh year," not only are you saying that God's going to provide, but, you know, you're really putting your life on the line. You're stepping where there's no footing. Is that exciting? And what happens if you're coming up to the fifth year and you're thinking, "How is God going to so bless this sixth year that we're going to have enough for 3 years?" It's pretty scary business. But it's a time for the Israelites to really depend upon God, to take him for his word. So when I'm thinking about fallowness in December, you know, we take the principle of fallowness and we don't interpret it and apply it in the literal way that the Israelites did. But the principle is pretty clear, to rest, to seek refreshment, and that we'll get to that in a little bit. But I'd encourage you to do this in December. Depend on God. I think of the plains of Moab when Moses was bringing the Israelites beyond this point where we're reading about now. But he's bringing them in the plains of Moab, and they can see the promised land in the distance. And God gives them this charge. He says, "You know, you're going to go in across the plains of Moab. You're going to go into the promised land. You're going to possess the land, a land flowing with milk and honey." And he says this, "When your flocks and your herds increase, and when all goes well for you, there's a danger. Because you're going to trust in your own strength. And you're going to say to yourself, you know, my hands and my muscles and my great skill and my great way of strategizing about things and my great mind, all of these have gotten for me this wealth." And God says, "You got to wait a minute, because part of depending upon God is, even when things are going well, to recognize that it's not going well because of you. We have certain responsibilities that we need to carry out, but things are going well for you, and all of your needs are being met because God is a gracious God and he's providing for you. And I say that because in the States, in the Western world, we don't really have much to worry about. I mean, even months ago when I was flat broke and after applying for some 30 jobs and nobody wanted me, I thought, what in the world is God trying to teach me about this? But the thing that he taught me is very clear. Dependence. Only when I was flat on my belly and desperate was I really ready for God to mold the clay and to realign my thinking and to refine my faith enough where I would really, truly believe and start to live out dependence upon him. So, this is the dependence thing that's... I can't tell you to do this or that or the other in December, but at least for me and my family, we're going to take a lot of time simply to reflect upon our own hearts and how God has supplied all of our needs and how we may have strength and skill, and we're to earnestly apply that in faithful ways, but ultimately everything comes from his hand. And it's a time for us to be still and simply to recognize that we are absolutely dependent upon God. And that we have no strength of ourselves. That's pretty humbling. That's pretty humbling. I love this next one, God refreshment. Literally, I want to read the passage in chapter 23. There are certain results that would happen because the ground was laid fallow. And certainly one of them that would be rejuvenated. But where is it? At the end of verse 12. That the donkey may rest, the slave born in your household, the alien as well, may be refreshed. Literally in the Hebrew it means this. I think this is pretty cool. To breathe oneself, to draw breath, to refresh oneself. Like after a race, if you've ever run a race like a mile for time, or years ago when I ran cross country, you just go out and blitz through the woods, and I'd always have these really small, skinny, athletic dudes flying up behind me and taking the lead, and I'd chase them like a bat out of Hades and try to catch up. But after the race, you know, there's that moment where you can see the finish line coming up and you cross that thing and you just totally drop and you collapse and you breathe yourself. There's something about you, you take in life and refreshment again. And that's what God is wanting his people to do. That's what he himself, I mean, think of it, after creating everything and filling it and forming it, in 6 days, he pulls back and he just simply rests. He takes a repose. He refreshes himself. And part of the DTR, the defining the relationship aspect, is that God wants us not only to get into the kingdom rhythm and to find dependence upon him, but also there's something called simple refreshment. You know, think of the analogy that's pretty clear about the ground. You're drawing out the crops from the ground, and in order for the crops to grow, they're drawing out nutrients from the soil and they're sucking up sunlight and all of this stuff, and there's a depletion within the soil, and that's one of the biggest gains or results from letting it lay fallow, that the animals can come and lay their manure, and the rains come and they carry a little bit of dust and the soil's replenished. And in the same sense, I think that our souls are putting out, we're pursuing the kingdom, we're following God, we're devoted to him, we're committed, but there's a depletion that happens. And part of this whole fallow business is that God is saying, you really do need to be refreshed. And in the New Testament, Mary and Martha are in front of Jesus, and one of them is serving like crazy, and the other is resting. And the sense is that there's a time and a place for both, rest and activity, but in this sense, rest. And that's what fallow is about. I'm going to ask you and engage all of you a little bit later when I talk about the implications for fallenness. But I got to tell you this, that this whole issue of refreshment and the whole practice of fallenness, it really pushes against a lot of my issues, because I don't want to pull back. I just want to steady myself, engage myself, and keep going. And the moment that I pull back and I'm not productive, I start to have identity issues. I do, because so much of how I frame my value and my worth and my identity comes from the things that I do. Whether it's carpentry or building or trying to learn and love my wife or speaking to all of you or whatever it is, there's always this trying to discern a level of performance. And based on that level of performance, I derive worth and value. And, to pull back is really frustrating. It really, grinds inside of me, where just the very thought of trying to do that just is really tough for me. And I think that what that does in terms of the refreshment aspect, it helps me to reframe where I derive my worth and my value and my purpose and my identity. It's not in me and the things that I strive to do, but it's because I'm God's kid and he loves me. That's my identity. And fallenness in terms of refreshment is a time for me to pull back from that and say, it's good to work hard and to become weary in our good doing, but you got to start to give that a little bit of thought and reflect on it. And for each of us, depending on how we're wired, we're going to find refreshment in different ways. And I've said this before, if you sit at a desk all day long doing computer stuff and all that, for one, your back is going to go out. I can guarantee you that. But you're going to find rest and refreshment digging in the garden or working on your place or doing whatever you're going to do. And if you're a guy who's out in the field digging ditches, you're going to find refreshment and rest slumbering on the couch, doing something like that, So I'm not going to say you need to do this or that, or it's going to look like this or that for you. I mean, that's something that you really have to determine. But for me, I'll tell you this. Liz said this the other day, you really just need to get up to Mountain Solitude. And I said, well, there's no Mountain Solitude tomorrow. And she said, well, just go by yourself. In other words, she said, get out of the house. Just go. For Liz, her refreshment is not having me around. Okay? Okay, that was pretty funny. This refreshment thing is for me, it's going to be a time where I'm going to start to read more, reflect more, meditate, practice the disciplines. You're probably thinking, Jim, you probably should do some weekly fasting. And I should, because man, my stomach, I've got heartburn and I'm eating the wrong things. I'm on a heavy carb diet. And that's something I'm going to start paying some attention to. Now, Lori, don't you smile at all, okay? We've had these conversations. But part of refreshment is simply engaging the disciplines. That's a value of the village, engaging the disciplines. Fasting, worship, reflection, teaching, prayer, all of these kind of things. That's what I'm going to be doing. And Liz is going to hold me to it, I hope. Refreshment. And that's pretty key. This last one, I hope that is a surprise to you, because of all the years that I focused and thought about and practiced fallenness, this next one I never really thought about until I considered it from the passage, and it's this: compassion. Verse 11 says this: but during the seventh year, let the land lie unplowed and unused. And here's part of the purpose for it. Then the poor among your people may get food from it, and the wild animals may eat what they have. Do the same with your vineyard and your olive grove. And it goes on talking about the weekly rhythm and how that gives time for the ox and the donkey, the slave born in your household, and the alien, all to be refreshed. It's a new concept to me because I've always thought about fallowness as just kind of me-centered, refreshing me. Jim's the focus. And what I find here, and that you find in the Ten Commandments when it's talking about the Sabbath, is that it's an expression of God's concern for not only me, Jim, but also for livestock. Do you ever think that God cares about animals? That he cares about servants and slaves and aliens? So I've been thinking about that. I mean, what do you do with that? This is kind of a new interjection into my thinking in terms of the implication of fallowness for me in December. I'm not quite sure what to do with this one yet. Go serve at a soup kitchen or something like that. I mean, it's easy to go and like give 2 hours of your time to do something, and then you feel really good about yourself. Well, look at me, how great I am, living the lifestyle that I'm living, and I can go throw some scraps to people who are poor, and then the benefit is really for me because I feel good about it. I don't think that's the direction I'm going to go, and frankly, I don't know where I'm going to go with this one. But I would say this, that the passage, if you're going to look at fallowness, the passage is dealing very directly with a concern and a care for people who are in need. Who are in need. A great example, I don't know how many of you were able to do this. I was busy trying to work on my own place and that kind of thing yesterday, but the Lewis's neighbor, I believe, right, had a lot of stuff on his house that he needed to do. And he couldn't do it himself, and so a bunch of villagers got together and went over and helped him, along with, I presume, other people in the neighborhood. I think that is a great way to practice concern for the poor. And matter of fact, finally, once we can get the building done, I would really love to see us as a community do more of that kind of thing. And just this week, as I was reflecting on this, how can we, in concrete and tangible ways, express this kind of thing? Well, we can do it in December. I mean, just look around you, your neighbors or the people that you're in relationship, your colleagues, your coworkers, whoever, fellow students. How are they in need? What do they lack? I mean, do they lack encouragement? Consider one another and spur them on to love and good deeds. I mean, that's one of the mantras here. So I'd encourage you in the month of December, in light of finding the rhythm, finding dependence, finding refreshment, express a God compassion for those around you. Whoever's in need, whoever needs encouragement or love or money or whatever it is, expend yourself, offer yourself. How are we doing for time? Huh? What's that? We're done. You're done, pal. Let's go outside. I'm kidding. Oh, yeah. Something jumped out at me as I was going through this whole fallow thing. I want to. I'm not Jewish and I'm not a rabbi, so if I don't say at least a little something about Jesus, you may as well call me a Rabbi Jim. Okay. So I'm going to talk a little bit about Jesus, and I'm going to do that from the Old Testament. Right after God gives these Ten Commandments, the DTR, to his people, the synecdoches, the worst-case scenarios, and said, you need to live into these. It's not a restriction of what you shouldn't do, but it's a permission to live life to the fullest. And here are the boundaries, and this is a law of liberty. And so right after he finishes all of these 10 words, he lists them all out. And finally, he says this in Exodus chapter 20, verse 23. And I think this is really profound. He says, "Do not make any gods to be alongside me. Do not make for yourselves gods of silver or gods of gold." I want to tell you this, that before I really came to faith in Jesus, I had a lot of ideas about who I thought God was or is, all kinds. And I was a pretty fanciful guy, you know. I had all kinds of ideas. And they were all very convenient for me. And so when I read this verse about don't make any gods to be alongside of me, and don't make for yourselves gods of silver or gods of gold, it strikes me hard. Because what it does, it challenges me to step back and to say, okay, who is God? And what is he like? And maybe I ought to suspend all my ideas and take a reprieve and to seek it out. God is not who you think he is, necessarily. God is who he reveals himself as in Scripture. And we can see a lot of who God is in terms of the splendor of his creation and the things that he makes and creates and does. But we can't form ideas about who we think God is based on our own selves. God is a person, a spiritual being. He's eternal. He's prior to and outside of the creation that he's made. He's this spiritual being, and if we were to even get a small glimpse of him, we would fall to the ground and perish. And so when I look at this and I think about God incarnate, that's a pretty heavy thing. So God says pretty plainly, don't do this. Don't in your ignorance and your small-mindedness try to fabricate some idea of who I am. And then in verse 24, if he says what not to do, he says what to do. In verse 24, he says, make an altar of earth for me and sacrifice on it your burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, your sheep and goats and cattle. Whenever I cause my name to be honored, I'll come to you and bless you. Then he goes about talking about how to make the altar out of stones that are uncut. Just find them in the field and throw them together. And the sense is that that's a shadow of something to come. So don't try to make yourself a god to suit yourself. Make an altar and understand that the heart of my relationship with you, God says, is an altar. And what happens on the altar? And a sacrifice. Then I look at Hebrews 10, verse 10, and it goes this way, and by that will we have been made holy through the sacrifice of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. Day after day, the priest stands and performs his religious duties. Again and again, he offers the same sacrifices, which can never take away sins. But when this priest had offered for one time one sacrifice for sins, he sat down at the right hand of God. When we talk about fallowness, I really think it's important to understand that the spiritual undergirding of Sabbath, refreshment, and rest is pivots on what Jesus has done. He's given us salvation. He's given us a relationship with God again. He's forgiven our sins. He's brought us into green pastures. He's the one who restores our soul. So when you're spending time reflecting on how to practice and reflect on and live out this principle of fallowness, keep in mind that at the heart of it is this one sacrifice for all time, Jesus the Lamb, who's laid down on the altar for our sin. Implications. I've, throughout the talk tonight, kind of woven in a bunch of the implications for me and for us But I want to engage all of you and just to talk a little bit. I think we have a few minutes to do that, 5, 7, 8 minutes. But I'd ask you to do two things. Talk to me about what fallowness is for you and for your family in December. What kind of things are you going to be doing or not doing, or what things are you going to be feeling? What are you going to be reflecting on? What's going to be your rhythm of fallowness through December? That's the first part of it. And then the other part of it that I'm really interested in, if you want to talk about this, don't go on and take a half hour to do it. Just say all you can in 30 seconds. But what kind of issues does fallowness push on for you? When you think of being fallow and doing all that we've talked about tonight, what does it stir up inside for you? What kind of roadblocks? What kind of obstacles? What kind of challenges do you see? I mean, not good, but it's pretty challenging. Thanks, Emily. Keith?
What you said about your own challenge, it reminds me of me. So I tend to not want to think about all the work. Think about things that you're using. You tend to let people spend the life of yourself.
Identify with you there. Yeah.
I'm not doing the things that are expected, like all the Christmas cards to everybody else.
Isn't that hard?
Yeah. But, you know, going back and the important relationships that we have, concentrating on those instead of just ritual things that we have to do as our parents.
That's good. Thanks. Ruben?
I always found it interesting because when I read the book of Exodus, it talked about letting the land rest. I grew up around farmers, a big farm country in the Sandy Valley. At one time, put out like a third of, you know, the West Coast's agricultural output.
Section. Good. Good. That could be a doctoral thesis right there. Anyone else? Yeah. So let's be lazy in December. Yeah, go ahead.
I still feel like it's hard on a daily basis. I feel like I know what to do with a few days off, what else will be there. But I'm still curious what it looks like on a daily basis. I think it starts on the daily basis so that you don't reach that point of realizing that you haven't been valid for years and you're about to break down.
Yeah. Well, I caught it, and I don't have an answer either. Something for all of us to work at. Yeah.
I grew up on a farm that had kind of a hillside that went down to a creek, and we called it a sump hill. And basically, it was constantly draining and constantly gathering nutrients, but it was never, it could never be plowed or used. My dad tried to use it several times. Useless. That was actually because it had too much good stuff. Like it was just overdone, and so they siphoned off water, and they this was years after we left the farm, and found new ways to drain that hill and make it really productive. And the last time I was in Iowa, there was this huge crop of corn there, and I said, "Wow, how did that happen?" And he explained to me that it was actually overstimulated with good things, but I think sometimes that's the issue too, is that I just get overstimulated, but there's so many good things to do, and so many, and that I particularly like having December the following month, because it's the time when everyone expects it to go crazy, and with all these good things, there are all programs and all these wonderful worship events and all that kind of stuff, but you just calm the way down, and I think that's the particular challenge.
Yeah, good point. Yeah.
That really resonates. Trying to go shopping with the kids. Don't even go there because, there's everything with glittery bows and things. Everything's decorated. It's just too much. It's just too much. And it's like that field, it's flabbergasting. And it's a mound of just things to look at and things to do, things to have, things to want to have. I'm thinking I might be, I think I might have to make my shopping differently where I don't shop as up for a small amount of time.
Yeah, I don't think I'm going to do any shopping. Okay, we better close. I'm getting the cutoff sign. Let me just pray, and then I'll share a few ways that we can respond. God, thanks for the time that we could spend reflecting upon this concept of being fellow and how it stirs us up and spurs us on. Thanks for all the comments and reflections from this community, and I pray that together, as we move ahead, that you would richly bless this month of December. Help us really to relish in your goodness and to find refreshment in your presence, each one of us. Thank you. Amen. A couple of different ways to respond. I guess I can talk about that right now. What's the first? Offering. It's been said that if you're visiting, no expectation. We're just glad that you're here. And I'm going to pass these around and just give as the Lord lays it on your heart. And the person in the back there, just put it under the pew if you could, please. And another way to respond is through communion, and it's a pretty simple visual reminder. If the Sabbath is a sign of the covenant, God's relationship with his people, kind of a visual reminder, a rhythm, then we have something that's even more precise. Jesus, on the night that he was betrayed, he took the bread and he broke it and he said, "Do this in remembrance of me. It's my body broken and given to each of you for the forgiveness of all of your sin." Then he did the same thing and the similar thing with the juice. He poured it and he said, "This is a sign. It's a visual reminder of my blood being poured out for you, because I love you, to forgive all of your sin. And do this in remembrance of me." So I'd encourage you, if you know Jesus, please come up and take these elements and reflect on God's goodness. And if you haven't arrived at a place where you really trust Jesus and love him, that's okay. Just witness what's happening and know that it's for us to reflect upon his goodness, his body and his blood given for us.